can sidle up to the orc next to you and say, hey, comrade, have you ever considered that you and I have common cause with each other against our bourgeois oppressor?
Hello and welcome to Crow's Nest Radio. Before we jump right into the interview with Cory Doctorow, I want to welcome new listeners to the podcast. My name is Eric Klein. This episode is a little different from the first three, since those shows are true stories told by the people who lived them. Check out the second half of Moss Pillows and 1 Million Giraffes if you're looking for a place to start. That's the true story of Ulla Helland, the young man who built a global online movement, almost by accident, just to win a bet and a case of beer. On this episode, an interview with sci-fi author and super blogger Cory Doctorow, who sat down with me in late May 2010 in the studios of KPFA in Berkeley while on book tour for the Win. Shorter versions of this interview aired on KPFA on The Morning Show and on the program Open Book. But here is the entire 40 minutes, which is my pleasure to share with you. I'm joined in studio by Cory Doctorow, whose latest book is For the Win, and previous books include Makers and Little Brother. Cory Doctorow also co-owns and co-edits the blog boingboing.net. Cory Doctorow, the premise for your book, For the Win, is that children in Asia are playing video games for money, sometimes in sweatshop-like conditions. Is that sci-fi?
Not really. This thing, gold farming, is what it's called, involves doing any repetitive task in a game in order to amass things that are valuable in the real world, or that are valuable in the games that people might in the real world give you money for, like really good swords or piles of money, gold or credits or really good spaceships. And kind of wherever you have people who are expected to do a repetitive task in order to get something they can have fun with, there will always be people who are willing to pay not to have to do the repetitive task. And so gold farmers are people who do the repetitive task and then sell the items outside the context of the game using PayPal or other systems to players who are either too lazy or too busy to do those tasks. Depending on who you ask, there are about 400,000 people who make a living this way.
400?
Yeah, 400,000.
400,000 people, and are they mostly young people?
They are mostly young people, that's right, yeah.
And so they make a living playing the game, doing things that either take a lot of time or skill, and then earning game things, fake things, but selling them for real money.
Yeah, I mean, fake is an interesting thing in this context. Is it faker than a credit default swap or a synthetic CDO? I don't know. I mean, it's fakeish. It's abstract, let's put it that way.
And what about the idea of their work conditions? Is that something that we know for a fact?
No. You know, there's a lot of different... I spoke to some gold farmers, and I spoke to some academics who study gold farmers, and I spoke to some people who own gold farms and got lots of different accounts. And one of the things that I realized early on was that the reason all these people were swearing up and down that it worked this way when this way was contradictory in each case is that it's not an organized industry. Everybody's doing it differently. We're the blind man and the elephant. We all have hold of a different piece. So definitely I talked to people whose conditions could be described as sweatshop-like, where there were lockdowns, where people were living and working in the same place and were subject to intense discipline, including loss of wages and loss of other amenities that go with an employer who provides your living space, so food and so on, for quote, misbehavior. And that's not unique to gold farming as an industry. I think it's pretty common across, especially South China, but also little village factories in China. There's a pervasive story in rural China that you can get rich by starting a gold farm. All you need to do is round up, a dozen boys, sit them down in front of computers on the very high-speed networking that's going in across rural China, and then, just sort of alienate them from the product of their leisure, And I don't think that it actually works that way. I think like a lot of entrepreneurial get-rich-quick manias, it holds out a lot more promise than it delivers.
And so to be clear again, we're talking about a real thing that's happening now, in 2010, in the world, people playing games for money to earn things of value to sell to people who have more money than them. But we're also talking about your book, For the Win, which is a sci-fi book that takes place something like 5 to 10 years in the future. And in that book, these young people are playing video games for money. So that's not the sci-fi part.
No, the sci-fi part is that they start a trade union. They have a unique advantage in the post-WTO history of labor, which is that everyone in their sector is in the same place. Even if they're in different countries or different cities or behind barbed wire and places where it's illegal to be an independent union organizer, they're all in the same video games.
And the video games we're talking about, I think we should define, they're known nowadays as, there's a ridiculous acronym.
MMORPG, the Massively Multiplayer Online Role-Playing Game.
Which, if we unpack for many of our listeners who probably have never played the other kind of video game.
So a role-playing game is a game like Dungeons & Dragons.
A board game.
A tabletop game. And it doesn't, you know, to make things even more complicated, it doesn't always involve playing roles. There's plenty of people who play Dungeons & Dragons as a thing about, you know, dice and probability and doing stuff as opposed to pretending with, you know, a lot of intensity that they are an orc or an elf or something else. So that's what a role-playing game is. An online role-playing game, well, that's a role-playing game where you play against the computer. A multiplayer online role-playing game would be one in which there are a few people playing against the computer. Left 4 Dead is a really good zombie role-playing game where there's, you know, maybe four or 8 players at a time playing with each other. And a massively multiplayer online role-playing game is one in which lots and lots of people inhabit the same virtual world. So the biggest of these is World of Warcraft with 11 million players.
Known around town as WOW.
WoW or Warcrack, because it's a very compelling game environment.
And so this is a brand new form of mass media that's incredibly popular, but almost, you know, only sort of known by people who don't play it in maybe Gee Whiz type media stories that cover its existence. But it's been around now for about as long as the high speed internet has.
And it's MMOs.
Growing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, in one form or another. I mean, some of the earliest network games were extremely multiplayer, but they were text-based. You know, MUDs and MUSHes, these virtual worlds. So this is the part that's not that's fictional, right? That they somehow organize, but
right. It's
all very fraught, you know. And the people who do gold farming are not well liked by the people who do the playing. Although the gold farmers do a lot of playing too. In fact, what they do is play, and oftentimes what they do in their off hours is play with their own characters. But they're not well liked. They're thought of as cheaters, and there's an enormous racial component. The cliche is that gold farmers are Chinese. Regular Chinese players who aren't gold farmers often find themselves at the wrong end of racial harassment in the games.
Wow. And
of course, like a lot of prohibition industries, we spend a lot of time blaming the supply side, but not the buy side. You know, so are the gold farmers bigger cheaters than the rich Western players who buy their gold?
Good point. And it's interesting that I didn't think about the racism that the internet tends to be more racist than real life. People sort of let that go where it's more culturally accepted to keep it inside in real life, and then on the internets they...
I don't think I agree with that.
Okay.
I think that the internet has a contradictory relationship with race. So on the one hand, it is often race blind, right? And on a individual-to-individual relationship, it's hard to know who you're talking to. And so it has an element of race blindness. On the other hand, there is a kind of juvenile, gross-out humor that is very common on the internet, in which shock words and shock ideas, including gross racism and sexism, and the kind of thing that, you know, the FCC won't let you put on the air if you're a right-wing shock jock, but that you might say, you know, when you're getting loaded with your buddies when you're 17 and you've snuck a case of beer from somewhere. That stuff, there's a lot of that. And that happens a lot in gaming culture. You know, if you slip a pair of headphones on, fire up your Xbox and grab a Call of Duty game from you know the marketplaces where you can find other Call of Duty players. Call of Duty is a war simulator. You'll find people calling each other really terrible names all the time. It's the extent to which it is genuinely discriminatory on the basis of race as opposed to merely transgressive juvenile humor is, I think, up for debate. And then, of course, there's an entirely different kind of racism on the internet, which is that it's a place where, you know, hate groups can find each other, just like it's a place where every other kind of marginal group can find each other.
So we're talking about these massive multiplayer online role-playing games, and they're mostly war-based, or some of the more popular ones are really about, they're either fighting future wars or Tolkien-esque, you know, fantasy wars. I mean, what do you think about the argument? I think that it's almost a true. It's like a truism. Is it true or not? But that they're irredeemably violent video games. And then you get people who, when children live in these worlds, they become little sociopaths. It's kind of a commonly accepted truth.
So Tom Standage, who is the tech section editor for The Economist and has written some really good books about the history of technology, wrote a really good piece for Wired about the history of moral panics in media and young people. And so the first medium in which people described young people as being led astray and irredeemably corrupted was the waltz, right? And the words that they used to describe the waltz were not far off from the words you just used to describe the games. It's subsequently we heard this being used to describe novels. We heard it being used famously to describe comic books.
Right.
You know, the Seduction of the Innocents was a kind of bogus piece of sociological research in the 1950s that was an excuse for a kind of mini McCarthyism, a witch hunt against comic book publishers that was especially hard on one of my most beloved institutions, Mad Magazine. It was also used on rock and roll. It's been used on rap. It's been used about movies. It's been used about television. It's been used about just about everything. I think that so without being too grandiose about this, I write novels. I think of them as art. And I think art is often about violence. And I think that you can make legitimate art about violence. And that the aesthetic experience of art is derived at least in part from having the audience viscerally feel the violence and the rawness and the emotion that the author is trying to conjure up or that the creator is trying to conjure up. So I kind of reject this argument that games are more immediate than novels, right? Clearly, novels can inspire people to do some strange, wonderful, and terrible things. You know, I introduce into evidence Ayn Rand, you know. But I think to elevate games to a special realm of media that are irredeemably corrupting is to inadvertently belittle all the other media like books, you know, because books have clearly been capable of making a big change in the world. And it would be you would be really kind of reactionary and dumb sounding. I mean, not to say that there aren't people who are reactionary and dumb sounding, but you'd be reactionary and dumb sounding to go around and talk about how books are destroying young people and they must be kept from the wrong kind of book. Now, that said, there are some very good games that are not combat at all. I mean, there's a I don't know about massively multiplayer ones. I'd have to think about it for a minute. But I'm thinking about one of my favorite games of this decade, which is Katamari Damacy, Kaito Takahashi's Nintendo game, or PS3 game, I beg your pardon. PS2? I forget the platform. Someone's going to send me a very angry, pedantic email about this. But it's a game that is the purest whimsy you can imagine, and he followed it up with a sequel called Nobi Nobi Boy. And between them, those two games are some of the most interesting, compelling, delightful, whimsical art I've ever seen. Portal, a very good game from Valve, who also made Counter-Strike and Half-Life. It's not only a logic puzzle, it's a beautiful story. And then there's games like Left 4 Dead, which are about mowing down, you know, endless waves of zombies. And I find that incredibly compelling and good art, too. So there you go.
So, Cory Doctorow, your book, For the Win, it's about young people playing video games for a living in, I guess, the so-called third world. What should we call?
The developing world.
The developing world. South China, Singapore, Mumbai. They're playing video games for money. They earn valuable things in game that they sell to people who have money in Europe and America mostly, I guess. But it's not just a book about video games. It's also a book about economics and both the fact that these workers try to organize, but also that these games are in fact giant economies in and of themselves. That part's also true, not science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of these games actually have chief economists in them because the economics of the game are so important to
Real people whose real jobs in 2010 is to be the chief economist of World of Warcraft.
To run the Federal Bank of EVE Online. Exactly right. To set monetary policy for video games. Partly because one of the reasons people play is to amass the evidence of their achievement, right? Gold, armor, what have you. In fact, one of the problems with these games is they're inherently inflationary. You play them for a long time, the rich get richer, and then there's all this money sloshing around. So they create what are called gold sinks, which are items that are extremely rare. They don't give you any play advantage, but they're in traditional economics speak, they'd be called prestige items. They derive their value from their rarity. And so, you know, a special purple limited edition suit of armor that you can't get except for a bazillion gold pieces that doesn't give you any advantage in play, but everyone who sees you knows that in order to have acquired that, you had to have spent a lot of gold, which means that you've spent a lot of time in world, these positional goods. So these so economists are tinkering in there. And the thing about games is that the value of the goods is contingent on the fun of the game, right? The value of the goods crashes when the game stops being fun. Moreover, the value of goods in game is subject to network effects. So the more people there are who want to play a game, the more valuable the currency is. That's not really true in the real world where we have open exchanges for currency, right? It doesn't matter if people don't want to live in America. The dollar is still worth something. It has a value that's kind of decoupled from the bank that issues it in a kind of interesting and abstract way. If you'll indulge me, I have a really good story about it. EVE Online is a game they sometimes call Spreadsheets in Space. It's a game about running mercantilist empires in space where there are very long lags to reach different resource centers, hubs, and customers. So you have to plan around it. And as with a lot of games, there's two teams. There's pirates and merchants. And in order to accomplish things, you start corporations and you have to manage them. It's basically HR and supply chain management disguised as a space game. And it's incredibly popular. The game runners decided that things were too easy for merchants and too hard for pirates, that being a pirate wasn't fun enough. So they introduced a really badass pirate ship, and it gave the advantage to pirates to the detriment of merchants, who were really upset about it. So this is pure, you know, Fed tinkering, right? There are too many savers and not enough speculators. Let's knock down the interest rate and see if we can get people to start taking their money out of the bank and putting it in the market, right? So they decided to privilege pirates over merchants. Merchants got upset, and two merchants decided that they were going to raise a syndicate to build a much better kind of juggernaut merchant spaceship that could be used to defeat the pirates. So they talked all the major corporations into sinking almost all of their money.
Major corporations in the game.
In the game, into their syndicate, with the promise that they would then use this money to build a super spaceship that they could all share in the plans for, build on their own, and defeat the pirates with.
The Death Star.
Yeah, kind of a Death Star, except there was no spaceship. It was a Ponzi scheme, and their objective was to resign from the game once they had a substantial portion of its monetary supply in their accounts, because when you resign from the game, the money disappears with you. And they created a whipsaw deflationary spiral in the game by sucking 80% of the liquid capital out of it in one fell swoop, right? So there's a truly economic form of play. And it's funny because if you can read an account of this, if you Google EVE Online, EVE Online Ponzi, you'll find it. And it's the most sort of profane, you know, juvenile account you've ever read. Like, essentially, if you want to see a truly exhaustive cataloging of all the ways we can have synonyms for human genitals, read this account.
And to what gain? What did they win by?
Satisfaction.
And what
revenge.
And what did it do to the players who remained in the game?
Screwed them.
And I guess this is an economics lesson and a game lesson. How?
Well, so here's a behavioral economics lesson for you in a nutshell, right? So, neoclassical economics predicts that if we play the ultimatum game, which is a game in which the experimenter designates one player as the offerer and one player as the acceptor, the offerer is given 100 pennies and he can choose to give as many or as few to the acceptor as he wants. If the acceptor rejects the offer, nobody gets anything. Neoclassical economics predicts that the offerer will slide one penny across the table and that the acceptor will accept it because you would have 0 pennies if you didn't accept it, and 1 penny is better than 0 pennies. And it turns out that in the real world, people usually offer about half. And if they don't offer about half, the recipients are more than happy to turn it down and punish both people for the satisfaction of punishing unfairness. There's a funny codicil to this, which is that if you studied Econ 101 and been told that the rational thing to do is to offer and accept 1 penny, you usually do. So it's kind of like there's a little virus of behaving like Homo rationalis, as depicted in 100 cartoonish neoclassical economics Gedanken experiments. So this is behavioral economics in a nutshell. We like to punish unfairness even when it doesn't make rational, in sarcastic finger quotes, rational economic sense. It's you know, as beautiful a behavioral economics example as you could hope for.
So, Cory Doctorow, your latest book is For the Win. It's about video games. It's a sci-fi book set 10-ish years in the future about video games that people play for their living. It's also about economics. We've been talking about economics now for the last 5 minutes. Which did you decide to write first? Did you want to write a book about economics or games?
I guess I wanted to write a book about labor first, because I grew up in Canada. I grew up near the Detroit border in Toronto, just 2 or 3 hours away. And I watched the UAW completely fumble NAFTA, right? I watched them...
United Auto Workers.
I watched them see their jobs go to Mexico because America had opened its borders with a country where labor was much cheaper. And, you know, this wasn't the first time in the history of labor this had happened. It was a common enough thing in the early days of the labor movement that manufacturers or bosses would move work from union towns to non-union towns, often with new or bring in new ethnic populations who are newly arrived on the shores to displace old workers, you know, even union breakers. So Pinkertons, for example, are often African-American who were excluded from traditional unions. So they were kind of sucked into breaking unions. So that's a pretty common experience. And the way that the union movement solved it is they unionized the new workers, too. Wherever you were, they would follow the boss and they would unionize. Now, obviously, it's a lot harder to go to Mexico if the Mexican government doesn't want to let you in and if they prohibited union organizing. And it's not to say that there aren't perfectly great union organizers in Mexico, but what the UAW needed to do was find solidarity with those workers. Instead, what they did was they retreated into xenophobia. And when I started hearing about gold farming, I suddenly realized here is a labor market where all the workers are in one place. And because they are in one place, they can communicate with one another and organize. And because they're young people using networks, chances are they're better at using them than their bosses, who are old people. And they can do things under the noses of their bosses that their bosses can't match.
And when you say one place, you mean that despite their physical location on planet Earth, their workplace is cyberspace. It's
exactly.
In the game.
They can all hang out and talk to each other. And so you can sidle up to the orc next to you and say, hey, comrade, have you ever considered that you and I have common cause with each other against our bourgeois oppressor?
Is that happening in real life as far as we know? Or is that the science fiction?
That's the speculative part, that maybe after 10 years of intense globalization of capital, labor will globalize too.
I was wondering also if the financialization of game economies, is that real or sci-fi? I mean, it seems like it should have happened already, that somewhere on Wall Street they figured out that the money is changing hands and there could be a derivative sold based on the game economies. But have they gone that far yet?
Not to the best of my knowledge. And I don't think it is happening. I think that I would have heard about it if it was. But again, that's kind of science fiction is a parable about what's going on in the real world. So I think that we do see a lot of securitization of, you know, random stupid debt, random stupid assets that have, you know, no underlying value, or the securities themselves can just be kind of become their own justification. I mean, that story at this point is really well known, that the subprime, you know, this is all junk and yet we're trading it avidly and pretending it's worth something. You know, I just gave a talk at the Massachusetts Library Association, and the problem with being the after lunch speaker when the lunch is the annual general meeting is that this year it was a really dismal annual general meeting, that the chairman introduced it with, we've been doing more with more, and now we have more with less. Now it's time to start doing less with less. And ended with, you know, many of you will not have a job in a year. So I was pretty bummed out. But he talked about how, it was a pretty depressing audience to talk to. And he talked about how every public service organization in the country was having this. Almost every sector is having this, except finance, of course. So I started thinking, and I was like, why don't we ask librarians if they can securitize library fines? We'll create bonds out of library fine debt, and then we'll create a whole, you know, kind of mountain of derivatives, and we'll just shop those around.
Yes. Seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? On the other hand, it creates a whole bunch of incentives for people to take out books from the library, right? So all of a sudden you'd have Wall Street, just like Wall Street was trying to convince people to take out liar loans. Maybe Wall Street would recruit an army of hucksters to get you to take books out of the library. That wouldn't be bad.
So Cory Doctorow, your latest book is For the Win, what we've been talking about. You've also written Makers and Little Brother. And these three books have all been offered for free on the internet, as well as for sale at normal book price in bookstores. I told a friend of mine that that's what you do. And he said, well, now it doesn't make any money then. You can't possibly make any money. But that's wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, here's another interesting behavioral economics, you know, counterintuitive move, right? So I do this for three reasons. The first one is purely financial. I think I make more money doing it. I think that, as Tim O'Reilly says, my problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. All the people who failed to buy my books today, most of them did so because they never heard of me, not because someone gave them a free electronic copy. And, you know, most people don't treat ebooks as substitutes for print books. They can, you know, only read them for so long on their screen before they go, oh my God, there's probably someone putting a lemon in his nose on YouTube. And then they flip away. You know, it's not that screens aren't good to look at for long times. I mean, we look at screens all day long, but that they're really hard to do anything that requires sustained attention. And books are cheap. They're easy to get a hold of. And, you know, so far so good. It also allows my readers to kind of recommend the book to each other by handing the book to each other, which is something physically proximate people have always been able to do, but virtual communities have a hard time with. So that's the economic justification. There's also an artistic and a moral dimension here. You know, artistically, it's the 21st century. If you're making art that you don't think people are going to copy, you're not making contemporary art. Because copying is never going to get harder, right? Hard drives aren't going to get like bulkier and less capacious and more expensive. It's not going to be fewer people who know how to type, you know, Hurt Locker BitTorrent into Google. Networks aren't going to get more expensive and harder to use. So from here on in, you know, barring nuclear Armageddon, copying just gets easier. So anything people like to copy, they will copy. And I don't mind if you don't want to make contemporary art, right? If you want to go off and be like, you know, the blacksmith of the Pioneer Village or a Civil War reenactor or the guy who makes the leather mugs at Ren Fair, that's totally cool. But I'm a science fiction writer and I'm supposed to be making, at the very least, contemporary, if not futuristic art.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Finally, there's this moral dimension, which is that you copy, I copy, everyone we know copies. And the fact that we're all guilty of violating copyright law puts us all in jeopardy of having our liberty taken away because we can all be blackmailed, right? So big corporations have been known to blackmail people for violating copyright law. For example, there's a kid at Swarthmore College who maintained a search engine that was used for lots of things, including finding music on campuses. And they went after him, but they couldn't sue him for writing a search engine. That's not illegal. So they went after him for downloading music, and they knew he downloaded music because he was 17 years old. And as a condition of the settlement, they said, we not only want all of your money, but we want you to drop out of the computer science program and change majors because we want to send a lesson that while it might be legal to write a search engine, it's not good for your health. You know, and so that's the risk, right? We're all guilty of something. We end up living in this world where any of us are vulnerable to this kind of blackmail. And I don't want to be a part of that problem. So I'm lucky. I get to do the thing that makes me the most money, that lets me do the best art I know how, and that lets me do it with a clear conscience and be part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
And so your books are offered under this thing that's called the Creative Commons.
Mm-hmm.
It's like copyright.
It is copyright. It's a license under copyright. Copyright says you as the author have the exclusive right to do a bunch of things with your books, copy it, display it, adapt it, perform it, and so on. And so people can only do that with your permission. And the Creative Commons license is a standardized way of granting permission for some of those things. So there's several different ways of writing a Creative Commons license. You go to the web and you click a couple of buttons. It's literally three buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes
And this is because people have set it up that way.
Yeah, that's right.
It exists now because of the work of...
of the Creative Commons organization, funded by MacArthur and Ford, a bunch of other organizations. And, you know, hundreds of millions of works have been licensed CC, which is awesome. And what it does is it takes the lawyers out of the licensing. It's always been possible for someone to license something to someone else. And it usually hasn't been necessary because, you know, up until the 70s, only works that were registered were copyrighted. So most works that you would encounter kind of in your cultural realm wouldn't be copyrighted anyways. You wouldn't need permission. And then of the ones that...
such as what? What do you mean?
Like anything. Anything you made wasn't copyrighted unless you sent a copy to the Library of Congress until the mid-70s, until the deposit requirement, Bern signatory. We became a Bern signatory. Bern agreement is something Victor Hugo, the Les Mis guy, came up with that would create automatic copyrights as soon as you created the work, as soon as the work was fixed in tangible form. So before then... many works weren't in copyright at all, so you didn't even need permission. And of the remaining works, chances were that you didn't need permission because what you were doing either didn't involve making a copy, because, you know, if you loan a book to someone in the real world, it doesn't involve making a copy, whereas loaning it to someone in the digital world does. There's no such thing as loaning someone a digital book unless you're actually handing them a computer. Even if it did involve copying, like, you know, you photocopied your favorite Dilbert cartoon and stuck it on your cubicle door, The Dilbert people could never find out about it. But because it's all on the internet, because everything on the internet involves copying, suddenly copyright laws become a piece of it. And so the stuff that we didn't need lawyers for before, now we need contracts, we need licenses for it. And so Creative Commons is standard licenses. Rather than, you know, using the internet as an excuse for full employment for copyright lawyers, what it does is it makes it really easy for people who want their stuff shared and want their stuff mixed and want their stuff reused to just slap a license on it that is, on the one hand, legally valid and long and legally, and also has a short human-readable summary for people who aren't lawyers, and finally has a machine-readable version that search engines can index. So you can say, if you go to Google Advanced Search, you can say, for example, find me web pages, only ones that I'm allowed to copy. And so you can constrain your search results to that.
So for instance, if I wanted to make a radio drama version of For the Win for KPFA...
Mm-hmm. If it's non-commercial and if you let other people remix your radio drama, yes, you can. Those are the two terms I set on my works.
And what about if you want to make $1 million when they want to make it into a movie?
Well, we sold the film rights to Little Brother to the guy who made Natural Born Killers.
Little Brother, your third ago book.
Yeah, 3 books ago. My first young adult novel. We sold those rights to the guy who made Transformers. And he has the exclusive commercial right. But he doesn't have the non-commercial right.
Hmm.
That's cool. I mean, kids have been making backyard movies that were non-commercial for as long as there have been movies. The fact that they can put them on YouTube and other kids can enjoy them, A, doesn't detract from the revenue that will accrue to the studio that makes the big commercial version, and B, is good, right? It's an unalloyed good. Kids being creative with stuff is an unalloyed good.
But haven't kids been asked to take their movies down at this point, their shot-for-shot remakes?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right, is that suddenly this thing that looks like an unalloyed good to me, because it doesn't fit within legal framework, is being prohibited. And I think that's wrong. I mean, copyright law is supposed to encourage creativity. That's what its purpose is set out as in the Constitution, right, in the Progress Clause of the Constitution. I think that when you start censoring creative works in the name of copyright, you're not promoting creativity anymore.
So does director Michael Bay, who has the license now for Little Brother, mm-hmm. your recent book, does he understand that—
It's not the director, it's the producer.
Sorry. So the producer. Okay, yeah. IMDb has failed me.
Right.
Do they realize that they've opened up the door now that the remakes— They can't shut them down.
And will I assume so.
Okay.
I assume so. My agent told them so. So, yeah, I assume so.
Well, I can't wait.
Would be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
So, Cory Doctorow, we're talking about For the Win, your most recent science fiction book. Little Brother was a great book that we should have been talking about, but we don't have time because it takes place in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I can summarize it in a minute if you'd like. It's kids are cutting school one day in the Tenderloin. Playing a kind of big scavenger hunt called an alternate reality game when terrorists blow up the Bay Bridge. And the DHS pick them up, and when they're taken in for questioning, instead of acting like cowed sheep, they act like citizens, and they ask to see badges and warrants, and they ask to have their call to their lawyer. And the DHS doesn't like this, and they decide to treat them presumptively as terrorists because they're doing a thing they can't explain, and they are not being cooperative.
The thing being playing a game that adults don't understand.
A crazy game that's kind of hard to, you know, it's Bruce Schneier calls the war on terror the war on the inexplicable. You know, why are you taking pictures of that building? I just like taking pictures of buildings. Are you sure you're not planning an attack on it? No, I just like taking pictures of buildings. I don't like taking pictures of buildings. You know? So they're playing this game. They get stress questioned. One of them isn't released. And they decide that they're going to declare war on the Department of Homeland Security and bring the Bill of Rights back to America. And it's a kid's book.
And it's also available under Creative Commons, so people can read it for free.
It's out in paperback this week, second week on the bestseller list.
There you go. So you're giving it away for free, and it's also on the bestseller list. So Cory Doctorow, we're talking about your book, For the Win, and you just summarized The Little Brother, and another book that the third recent book is called Makers, and that book, sci-fi fantasy as well, 6 years-ish in the future.
Some contrafactual near future, yeah.
And this book is a really attractive fantasy world where a Steve Jobs type guy gets a hold of Kodak and Duracell, the large corporations, buys them, shuts them down. They no longer make film and disposable batteries. They fund entrepreneurs who revitalize like the American manufacturing economy. They fund people who like to make stuff.
Yeah, they have an industrial economy without a factory, which is, you know, that's the great dream, right? You've got the industrial economy produced all these wonderful benefits in the form of productivity, right? It's great that we all have clothes now and that there's food for everybody. But it also deprived workers of the dignity of deciding how they were going to work because we were all chained to the same assembly line. And if I decided that the weather was too nice to work and I wanted to knock off for the day, you couldn't do your job. And what they do is they do small artisanal manufacturing that has the efficiencies of the industrial age, but without the control. It doesn't work, though. They call it the new work. 20% of the American workforce relocates to a dead mall somewhere in the suburbs to start one of these co-ops. But they can't spend money fast enough on these little companies. And as a result, most of the capital that's raised for these things never gets spent. The return on investment is consequently very low. The market collapses, but they keep making stuff. And it's actually a parable about life in the Bay Area. I moved to San Francisco during the dot-com boom, and I stayed through the bust. The interesting thing about the bust was that even though all the money left San Francisco with like an audible popping sound, people stayed and kept making stuff. And it turned out that you didn't need Aeron chairs or foosball tables or baristas to make the internet. You just needed computers and enthusiasm and someone's Wi-Fi network. And so that's what the second act of the book is about. It's about what happens when they make stuff, even though there's no more money left.
And one of the main characters in the book, Makers, is a former San Jose Mercury News tech reporter turned super blogger. And one of the things that I found difficult to suspend my disbelief on with this character was that she had so much influence as a blogger. But then because I know who you are as an author, that you also blog at Boing Boing, I was wondering if there was, and Boing Boing is very big, mm-hmm. even though maybe some of our listeners don't know Boing Boing. Are there times where you've actually seen evidence of the influence of this large blog?
So I think the key thing here is a lot of influence in a small, narrow area of endeavor, right? So even if lots and lots of people are doing something, even if hundreds of thousands of people are doing something, 400,000 gold farmers, it's just a drop in the bucket. But there are superstars. There are people who are key influencers in all of those areas. And she's very influential because in this narrow but important sector, she's the most trusted voice. And I've certainly seen that happen with blogs. And I've certainly seen that blogs within a narrow area can really help people. You know, there's a great online comic called XKCD. It's a really geeky comic. And when I found my first XKCD comic, someone forwarded it to me. It was really funny. And there were only a few up. And I emailed the author and said, do you mind if I put this on Boing Boing? Because it wasn't Creative Commons licensed. I said, would you consider maybe Creative Commons licensing? It might make it easier for other people who want to tell their friends about your awesome comic to tell them about it. He said, yeah, I'll try that. And now he's like, he's got his he's living the dream. He's got a house outside of Boston with a ball pit in the living room, and he sits in the ball pit and plays Xbox with his best friend and his sister all day, and then he writes a comic once a week, and the rest of the time he just opens checks from the t-shirts he sells, and he does incredibly well, and he credits me with having helped him do that, right? With putting that on Boing Boing and that having launched him off onto just like having attained absolute nerdvana. And so, yeah, there's lots of times I hear that story a lot from people. It's the most gratifying thing about Boing Boing. You know, you featured my t-shirt, now I make t-shirts for a living. You featured my novel and ended up on a bestseller list, and now I got to quit my day job. You helped our cause raise money. You know, my friend Peter Watts is a Canadian science fiction writer. I'm also Canadian. He drove from Toronto to the States to help a friend move. And on the way back, there was an exit customs check, which he'd never encountered on the way out of the U.S. And so he was just parked up at the stop gate, waiting for it to rise. And he looked back and there were two customs guys in his trunk. And they'd opened his trunk without asking him. And he got out of the car and he said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Get back in your car, sir." And he said, "But what's going on?" And they maced him. They knocked him to the ground. They beat him up. They rolled him in the slush. It was snowing. He didn't have his coat on because he was driving. They took him to a cell. They charged him with a felony obstruction and assault. They left him in an unheated cell overnight. They released him without his coat into a blizzard the next day. And he was eventually convicted of obstruction, which is basically, as near as I can work out, failure to quickly obey a lawful order of a law enforcement officer. We raised his legal defense through Boing Boing. We raised $60,000. The $60,000 he spent, he had a suspended sentence. He can't come back to the U.S., but at least he's not going to jail for 2 years here. And so that's the other kind of thing that we can do, right? We can call attention to worthy causes.
Wow. Also in Makers, a big main villain character is the Disney Corporation. And in this case, it's the Disney Rides entertainment parks. And I think I've noticed that you seem to pick on Disney a lot.
I wouldn't say I pick on them because I celebrate them rather a lot too. I mean, my first novel is kind of a love letter to Disney World, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. I like the theme parks. I think that artistically the theme parks are really interesting in a way that most people haven't yet twigged to. They enjoy the freedom of lowbrow art to make stuff without anyone looking at it too closely and asking exactly what's going on there. And I think that as dark rides go and as constructed environments go, very few people have gone at it with the seriousness of Disney Imagineering, and no one's been as successful. So I really enjoy that. At the same time, as a corporation, Disney's done some really creepy, awful things, including agitating for and winning some very draconian copyright laws. So that ambivalence, which I think it's impossible not to be ambivalent about a large corporation, right? They may make things you love, but somewhere in anything that big is something not very nice at all. And so I'm able to express that ambivalence in literature. And, you know, I think that's that ambivalence or blended feeling is really the core of great art. You know, that if you can evince an emotion in your art that is neither one thing nor the other, but two contradictory things at the same time, love and disgust, say. It's like sprinkling a little salt in the chocolate. It's those two contradictory flavors that make each other kind of pop out. So, yeah, I often write about it because I often think about it.
Well, Cory Doctorow, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I had a great time.
Thanks, sir. I love the idea that every time Mickey Mouse is up...
Well, not even Mickey, the earliest Mickey cartoon.
It's every time Steamboat Willie
comes up. Yeah, Mickey Mouse is a trademark. He never expires so long as they use him in...
Okay, it's just Steamboat Willie. It's just that one cartoon. Well, why can't
Well, because once that cartoon goes in, then the next year the cartoons they made the next year will go in, and the next year the cartoons the basically...
But they don't make any money off Steamboat Willie.
No, but they do make money off of Snow White, which is only 3 years later. So if you...
They have to hold the line.
If you free Mickey this year, in 3 years you'll free Snow White. And, you know, a couple of years after that you'll free something else. And
okay.
Before you know it, it'll all be public domain, which is just as it should be, because that's how Walt was able to make all of his stuff.
Right, I like that point that you made. So there you have it. That last minute there was, of course, recorded after the formal interview ended, while Cory Doctorow was gathering up his things to rush off to the next stop on his Bay Area book tour. This was a special interview edition of Crow's Nest Radio, online and podcasting at crowsnestradio.com. The next episode of the Storytelling Show will be up online on June 20th, 2010, the same night it will air on terrestrial radio at 6:30 p.m. on KPFA in the Bay Area. If you want to tell your true story on the podcast/radio show, my email is crowsnestradio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.